for inviting me to come to this wonderful institute and give me the chance to give a talk on the research that we've been doing recently. And first of all, I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators. So this work was done by Yeji Park, who was a Princeton student and is now at the Korea Advanced Institute of Science Technology, and also Sugum Chung at the Institute for Basic Sciences and Seoul National University, also in Korea. And finally, work with Rex Lundgren, who is a PhD candidate at University of Texas, Austin. Okay, so this talk is about topological phases. And the first class of topological phases that we know the most about are the so-called free fermion topological phases. So these are quite well understood. Their classification, their mathematical classification, is very well understood and was done by these authors. And physically, these phases are gapped in the bulk, and mathematically, they're characterized by some topological invariant, which is either an integer or a Z2 number for these free fermion phases that corresponds. So this invariant sometimes corresponds to some quantized physical observable, for example, like a Hall conductivity that is quantized or analogous properties. And on the surface, these phases have some gapless states that are protected by a certain symmetry. And what is interesting about these states is that they cannot be realized by the lattice models in the same number of dimensions as the surface that preserve the symmetry. So for example, if you take a three-dimensional free fermion topological phase, it has a two-dimensional surface, but you cannot realize that two-dimensional surface state in any two-dimensional lattice model, okay, that preserves the same symmetry. So that's kind of an interesting property. And so if we focus on three-dimensional topological phases, which will be the focus of this talk, it's really through the observation of these two-dimensional surface states, okay, that these states have been discovered. So for example, for three-dimensional topological insulators, one can do angle resolve photoemission measurements. And here you see the Dirac cone dispersion of these surface states very beautifully. Then there's also topological superfluid phases. So I'll be talking about those in the first part of my talk. For example, helium-3b. So here the evidence is a little bit more complicated. It's not as clear, but the idea is that you can do essentially specific heat measurements, and you see that there's a discrepancy between the observed value of the specific heat and the bulk value of the specific heat that you can calculate. And also you can do some acoustic impedance measurements. Essentially, you send some sound waves and they bounce back on the surface, and you can measure the scattering of these acoustic waves by the surface. Okay, so these sort of indirect measurements seem to suggest that these topological superfluids have interesting surface states. And also, there are three-dimensional topological superconductor phases that are conceptually similar to those. And so, for example, copper-doped bismuth selenide. So in this case, you can do point contact spectroscopy measurements. And so you attach a contact on the surface, and theory predicts for you that there should be a special zero bias peak if there's a surface, if there's an interesting surface state. And that seems to be what is seen in an experiment. But so this is still a little bit controversial as well. But in principle, it seems that these topological states have also been observed in an experiment. Okay. And so we tend to describe these phases by free fermion theories. Okay. But the question is, are these surface states truly free fermion systems? Okay. So these are real materials. And so we expect that real materials have interactions. For example, in a topological insulator, there will be Coulomb interactions generally. And so in principle, strictly speaking, these cannot be free fermion systems. And so if they're not free fermion systems, how can we describe and perhaps measure their interactions? Okay, so that's kind of the main focus of this talk. Okay, so this is the outline of my presentation. So it will be in two parts. The first part will basically talk about topological superfluids, and I will try to describe possible interaction effects on the surface of these systems. And the second part will be about topological insulators, and I will try to develop a general theory of interactions on the surface of these systems. Okay, so let's start with the first part. So here we're going to talk about topological superfluids. So the theory of topological superfluids historically was developed by, at least in some cases, was developed by analogy with topological insulators. Okay, so a topological insulator is clearly a free fermion system, is described by band theory, and the idea is if you essentially replace physical quantities in the topological insulator by their superfluid or superconductor counterparts, then you obtain a topologically non-trivial superconductor. Okay, so the idea is that if you think of an electron as really being a Bogoliubov quasiparticle, and if you interpret your Bloch Hamiltonian of the insulator as a Bogoliubov-Degen Hamiltonian, and likewise if you interpret the band gap of that insulator as a pairing gap, then essentially your topological insulator becomes a topological superfluid. Okay, so that gives you a sort of free fermion description of a topological superfluid. Okay. Yes. I will, actually. So that'll be important for this talk. So in fact, this is why in this talk I will actually focus on the superfluid rather than the superconductor, which does not have a Goldstone mode. Absolutely. Okay. So indeed, even though we can do this formal translation, there is a fundamental difference between an insulator and a superfluid. Okay, so in a superfluid, pairing really comes from interactions. Okay, this is really an interacting effect. And another way to see this is that the pairing gap in a superfluid comes from a dynamical order parameter, okay, whereas in an insulator, the band gap is really a static quantity. So so an order parameter is something that fluctuates in principle, both at zero and at finite temperatures. So what is traditionally done in this BDG description of topological superfluids is to do mean field theory, essentially. So we ignore fluctuations of the order parameter. We ignore both thermal and quantum fluctuations of the order parameter. And that leads to a theory in which the quasiparticles are free fermions. Okay, and then we can apply the classification of free fermion topological phases. So the question I want to ask in the first part of this talk is, how do order parameter fluctuations of the superfluid order parameter affect the physics of topological superfluids, in particular, the physics of their boundary modes? Okay, so I'll just give you the main message. So the main message that we find, at least in the case of this specific topological superfluid, is that order parameter fluctuations in the bulk can induce interactions among the boundary states, which are initially free Majorana fermions, but by exchanging essentially quanta of these order parameter fluctuations, these Majorana fermions can effectively interact. Okay, and so although one could look at both thermal and quantum fluctuations, for simplicity here, I will focus on quantum fluctuations of the order parameter, and furthermore, I will focus on a physical system because, in fact, this is the only known topological superfluid, although some of these considerations could also apply to solid-state topological superconductors such as copper-doped bismuth selenide, because not all order parameter fluctuations are gapped. Okay, but that could be studied in future work. Okay, so let me remind you of what the phase diagram of helium-3 is for those of you who are not familiar with this. So at high temperatures, there's a normal liquid. And at low temperatures, both at zero pressure and in a certain range of pressures, there is a superfluid phase called the B phase, which is fully gapped. And this is what we mean by topological superfluid in this material. Okay, it's this B phase. And so if we focus on the fermionic quasiparticles in this system, they are described by the so-called Balian-Vertomer state. So this is a very old work done in the early 60s. And so essentially the superconducting, the superfluid order parameter is a spin triplet, a P-wave order parameter. Okay, so rather than being a spin singlet S-wave, which is what you have in conventional superconductors such as lead, for example, here, you actually have a P-wave spin triplet order parameter. Okay, so if you write down some mean field Hamiltonian for these quasiparticles, there will be a kinetic term and a pairing term. And if you look at the pairing term, it has more structure than in an S-wave superconductor. Okay, so there is a magnitude of the order parameter, which is some real number, So this controls the size of the gap. There's a Josephson phase. Okay, so this is the same as you have in an S-wave superconductor, but now there is some additional quantity, okay, a 3x3 matrix R of relative spin orbit rotations that acquires a particular expectation value in the superfluid ground state. Okay, so essentially this matrix relates spin and momentum. Okay, so you can think of this order parameter as being something like dynamically generated spin orbit coupling. Okay, so for example, if you think of R naught as being the identity matrix, then you would have essentially sigma dot k, and that would look like spin orbit coupling. And so this ground state here does not have an invariance under separate spatial and spin rotations. It only has an invariance under combined spin and orbital rotations. Okay. So in the case of helium-3, we need to consider these three quantities, the gap, the phase, and this matrix, as being various components of the order parameter. Okay, so the standard story tells us that there are Majorana fermions on the surface. So to find those Majorana fermions, one would essentially try to study the eigenstates of this Bogoliubov-Dejean Hamiltonian, but in a semi-infinite geometry. So if you have a boundary and you try to solve this effectively signaled particle problem, you would find Majorana. You would find essentially Andreyev bound states that would have the dispersion of a free Majorana fermion. And so this is what you get if you look at a constant order parameter in the background. Okay, so if you fix the magnitude, the phase, and this matrix R, then this is what you find, and this is what is traditionally done. Okay, when people look at theoretical descriptions of helium 3b. Okay, so however, as I was mentioning earlier, truly these are dynamical variables. Okay, they're subject to quantum fluctuations and also thermal fluctuations. So as I was saying earlier, here we will focus on the zero temperature limit, so we only have quantum fluctuations. So in principle, all these three quantities can fluctuate, but so if I look at, for example, the amplitude delta naught, so because this is an amplitude mode, this will have a gap. Okay, so in fact, the gap of that mode is comparable to the actual quasi-particle gap, and so we can ignore these modes if we're interested in the low energy limit. So I remind you that these Majorana fermions are found dispersing inside the bulk superfluid gap. So if we're interested in the physics of these Majorana fermions, we will look at energies that are much smaller than the superfluid gap. Okay, so we can ignore these amplitude modes. So this leaves us with four gapless modes, essentially Goldstone modes, as Zhensheng was pointing out. These are bosonic, and so there's four of them because there is one phase mode, which is the fluctuations of the Josephson phase, as in an S-wave superconductor. But now, because we have this extra structure, we also have three spin orbit modes, which essentially correspond to fluctuations of this 3x3 matrix. Okay, so there's three independent directions. You can think of this matrix as an SO3 matrix, and there's three generators of SO3, and therefore there's three separate Goldstone modes coming from this matrix. Okay, so we want to look at the effects of these Goldstone modes on the Majorana surface states. Okay, so the idea here is pretty straightforward. So we go back to our mean field Hamiltonian, but now we let the order parameter be a dynamical variable. Okay, so instead of having a pairing amplitude that only depends on the relative momentum k, okay, that, for example, that appears here, that I wrote earlier when I was just writing the order parameter for a static uniform background, and now we will allow this phase and this matrix to fluctuate, so they will be functions of some center mass coordinate. Okay? And furthermore, we will look at small fluctuations, so instead of having the exponential e to the I phi, I expanded it in for small phase fluctuations, and likewise, one can expand this rotation matrix close to its expectation value. So by symmetry, one can always choose the the expectation value to be the identity matrix, and then one looks at small fluctuations about the identity matrix. So in particular, this means that we're not looking at vortex configurations of these order parameters because we assume that theta and phi are small. Okay, we're looking at small sort of spin wave type fluctuations. Okay, so now we can insert that in our pairing term, now generalized to include center of mass motion. Okay, and now we can look at the physics of this coupled fermion boson problem. So we have fermions, spinful fermions, and we have four species of bosonic modes. Okay, so so this was for an infinite system. Now remember that we are in a semi-infinite geometry. So we need to do that if we're to see the surface Majorana fermions. And so there will be a coupling between surface Majorana fermions and bulk Goldstone modes. Okay, so the first task is to figure out what is the form of this coupling between the surface fermionic modes and the bulk fermionic modes. So the bulk fermionic modes are gapped. Essentially, we can integrate them out, and this will not generate any kind of interesting physics, but the surface fermionic modes are gapless, so we need to keep them. Okay, and so the coupling between the surface fermionic modes and the bulk Goldstone modes is found to be this form. Okay, so essentially, only one of the four Goldstone modes ends up coupling to the surface Majorana fermions. So first of all, the Josephson phase actually drops out altogether. And so this can be understood because the Majorana fermions are neutral particles, so they cannot couple to the phase. And furthermore, only one of the three spin orbit modes couples to the Majorana fermions. And this we interpret as expressing the fact that the Majorana fermions have an Ising spin. Okay, so if you take a Majorana fermion, there's actually not enough freedom to construct an SU2 spin. Okay, there's only a single spin component, which actually corresponds to the mass of the Majorana fermions, and this means that the spin of the surface modes, in a sense, can only couple to one of the spin or spin orbit modes in the bulk. Okay, and so
in this case, the surface is only
one. That's right. So it's a two-dimensional Majorana fermion,
yep.
But there's only one species. Correct, nuclear one, exactly. That's right. I see. That's right. Absolutely.
Yeah, so it's one.
I see. That's right. That's right. I think, yeah, that's a good way of seeing this. And absolutely. So this operator transforms under a spinner representation of SO2. Okay, that's absolutely correct. Okay, so very good. So this is the coupling. And now what we're interested in doing is deriving a purely surface theory. Okay, so and now we have a coupling between the bosonic modes of the bulk and the surface Majorana fermions. Now what we can do is integrate out the bulk bosonic modes and generate an effective action for the surface Majorana fermions. Okay, so so this is not very hard to do. So you have a Goldstone mode in the bulk, so it's essentially a free boson, and it's coupled linearly to this this bilinear of Majorana fermions. And so when you integrate this out, this will give you a four fermion, an interaction term between the Majorana fermions. Okay. So here there's a small subtlety that actually ends up simplifying the calculation. So a Goldstone mode usually is gapless. However, here the bulk has a small symmetry breaking term, okay, that actually gaps out the Goldstone mode from the start. So it turns out that in helium-3b, the spin and spatial rotations is actually not an exact symmetry of the problem. There is a dipole-dipole interaction that actually gives you a small mass term for the Goldstone modes. Okay, and actually there's a physical interpretation of this. So this phase theta, which in principle could take any value, actually has a preferred value in the bulk, which is called the Leggett angle, as a result of this dipole-dipole interaction. And you can think of this small this small mass term for the Goldstone mode as essentially representing the energy cost for phi deviating from its preferred value in the bulk. Okay, and so there's a small mass term, and so this makes this integral actually essentially simpler. Sure, you will not generate any kind of non-local interaction between the Majorana fermions. You will get a local interaction between them. okay, because of this small mass. Okay, so one can do that. Yes.
Physical units, how big is that now?
Good question. So it's pretty small, even in terms compared to the bulk gap. Yeah, this is known. So actually, you can express this. So this coupling here, you can express it in terms of the coherence length and some dimensionless interaction strength. So this is all well known, and it's a pretty small number actually. So in a sense, you do get a short range interaction, but in other words, the coupling constant that you get actually is quite large for the Majorana fermions because of the fact that this boson mass is quite small. Okay, so essentially, the bottom line for this part of the talk will be that actually these surface Majorana fermions are fairly strongly interacting because of that.
But if the temperatures were bigger than this mass scale, then the non-local effects might be important.
That's right. So if we were looking at thermal fluctuations in addition to quantum fluctuations, then that's right. So here I'm considering a strict zero temperature limit, so I'm always in the limit of T much less than this gap. But you're right, that's a very interesting consideration. Absolutely. So if you do this path integral, then you generate this quartic term, and if you look at the leading term, it's a short range interaction, and the coupling constant is inversely proportional to this this small gap, okay? This small bosonic, the small gap of the quasi-Goldstone mode. All right, so one has this interacting Majorana fermions. We can try to look at what is the effect of this interaction. Okay, so if we do perturbation theory, you will find that because you have a Majorana fermion that has a zero density of states at the Dirac point or at the Majorana point, then this interaction is perturbatively irrelevant. Okay, so certainly the Majorana fermion, the gapless Majorana fermion, is stable. However, here we have a finite coupling constant, and one can ask, what phase can one obtain if this coupling is large enough? Okay, so the first thing one would do is to look at possible broken symmetry states. Okay, so to do that, we can try to enumerate all the possible order parameters that Majorana fermions can have. Of course, there's a potentially infinite number of them, but we can look at sort of more obvious order parameters that are independent or that are up to linear order and momentum. Okay, so if you do that, so the lowest order in momentum order parameter is a mass term. Okay, so this effectively corresponds to this Ising spin I was talking about earlier. So this order parameter would break time reversal. Spontaneously, it would open up a gap for the Majorana fermions. And the next, to zeroth order in K, this is all you have. To first order in K, the only thing you have is actually a nematic order parameter, which essentially gives you an anisotropic Dirac home. Okay, so this one preserves time reversal, but it breaks rotation symmetry. So in principle, there could be many more, but we could try to ask what happens to those two in mean field theory. And so for example, for the nematic order parameter, there is a second order transition in mean field, but actually this transition can only occur for a negative value of the coupling. And here our microscopic theory gives us a positive coupling. So this nematic order parameter is ruled out. And if we look at the mass order parameter, then we do find a transition that is first order in mean field towards this massive time reversal breaking phase. Okay, so this occurs at some particular value of the coupling. So one could try to compare that to the microscopic coupling, but here things become not very accurate because we're doing mean field and things depend on an explicit cutoff, okay? But so depending on how you choose your cutoff, you could actually be in the time reversal breaking phase or not. But even if you're not in the time reversal breaking phase, you could be close to this massive phase could be metastable in the actual system. Okay, so that's a possibility. So this concludes the first part of my talk. So what I've told you is that if we look at quantum fluctuations of the superfluid order parameter in a topological superfluid like helium-3, so this can induce effective interactions amongst the surface Majorana fermions. Okay, so this was not considered previously in standard discussions of topological superfluids. In mean field, we find a first order transition towards a time-versal breaking phase of gapped Majorana fermions. Okay, so experimentally, all the evidence suggests that the Majorana fermions are gapless. So to agree with this theory, it would tell us that the coupling is less than the critical coupling, but one could still be, as I was saying earlier, in a metastable regime where the time-versal breaking surface state is nearby. Yes?
How would you tell if you
have... Yeah, that's a great question. So that's what we're trying to determine now. How could you measure or measure something that would tell you that this time-versal breaking phase is nearby? Okay, so so we're not sure yet. So we're trying to compute, for example, some susceptibility. So maybe there's a frequency. Yeah, I'm not quite sure, actually. We're trying to figure that out. Yes. Okay, so this is one possibility. So this would be broken symmetries. One interesting possibility is that if fluctuations make this transition continuous, then, as has been studied earlier, the corresponding critical point would actually be supersymmetric. Okay, so that's a feature of having a single Majorana fermion on the surface and looking at that particular time-versal breaking transition. So that's a possibility. Another interesting possibility would be that there is an instability, but it is not towards a Broca symmetry phase, but rather towards a surface topologically ordered phase. Okay, so this has been considered in these papers. And here what we're saying is that this interaction here could be a mechanism to generate that. Okay, so that we don't know. One would have to somehow tune a parameter, perhaps pressure, to move towards the transition, but in principle, that's a possibility. Okay, any questions for the first part? Yes. Disorder, it's a good question. So certainly disorder, I would think, would round off these transitions, or depending on the type of disorder, that's certainly true. Do you mean for this transition, for example? Yeah, so I think, we studied the effect of disorder on a different transition on the surface of a 3D topological insulator that is also supersymmetric. In that case, disorder tended to move you away from the critical point. Okay, so disorder might destroy this physics. If these results carry over, it would seem that it destroys this physics. The nice thing about helium-3 as compared to a solid-state system is that it's extremely clean. Okay, having disorder in helium-3 is actually pretty difficult. You can have, for example, a mixture. You can have helium-4 impurities and things like that. But actually, helium-3 is an extremely clean system. So actually, if there's any hope of observing these exotic supersymmetric quantum critical points, I would think it would be in this system rather than in a solid state system. That's a very interesting question. So this, I have no idea. So this is it's a strongly coupled conformal field theory. It's certain things are known about it, but it's certainly there's only certain things one can compute exactly. If you look at deforming this theory, it probably becomes even harder. But that's an interesting question to consider. So I don't know if this could be the seed for if there's something in this theory that could help you developing this STO phase. That I don't know, but one would need to try to come up with some methods to study that, but that's certainly an interesting question. Yeah. Yes?
So here you consider the data is continuous for us by testing that about the water configuration.
Yeah, that's right. So here, that's right. So if one considers a sort of a vortex defects of these, so if I understand correctly, if you have a vortex line, for example, in helium-3, then I think that this actually will trap a gapless chiral mode, or maybe actually a helical mode, because this is a time-versal preserving system. So I think you will trap some gapless zero mode. So this has been studied also in the context of 3D topological insulators. So if you look at a 2 pi vortex line, this will trap some zero mode. So I think a similar physics occurs here. Now, if you're asking, so this is sort of understood in the non-interacting case. Now, if you look at in the presence of, I guess it depends what you want to look at. So if you have many of these vortex lines, then I think you essentially are driving a, if you proliferate these lines, then you drive a transition towards some kind of disordered state, I would think. I would think it's a normal state. I haven't thought too much about that. That's a good question. Yes. That's a good question. Yeah. So I guess, yeah. So this is where my knowledge of helium-3 physics is quite limited, but I think it's a possibility. So, I mean, I know that from the experimental point of view, the claim is that these surface Andreev bound states essentially will affect the results of transverse acoustic impedance measurements. And so this is one of the smoking gun signatures, at least that people have claimed, that that point to the existence of these surface states in helium-3. So it's not clear to me how they would interact, but I think the general question of how these modes can interact as a result of other fluctuations, I think, is quite interesting. The shape of the surface, right. Yeah, that's right. Yes, I would think that this would certainly play an important role because, you know, one derives the form of these Majorana surface states for a sharp boundary. And now if this boundary is allowed to fluctuate, then I would expect that, that's right, that there would be a similar kind of coupling. So I know that, for example, Volovic has studied a lot of these sort of gravity-type physics in helium-3. It could be that this is something that he has looked at. But I'm not personally aware of studies of that. All right, so I'll move on to the second part of the talk. So here, the idea will be to study different physics, but in also a three-dimensional topological phase. This time, the sort of well-known 3D topological insulator. And the idea here will be to try to construct a general theory of interactions on the surface of the system, and essentially how can we characterize these interactions, and how can we potentially measure them in a way that is mostly materials independent. Okay, so Landau fermi-liquid theory, I think most, if not all of you, have heard about this or know what it is. It's a rather important part of condensed matter physics. It's a fundamental paradigm of many body physics developed by Landau in the 50s and further refined by Abrakosov and Helotnikov. And the idea here is to exploit an adiabatic continuity between a Fermi gas and its interacting counterpart. Okay, so one essentially assumes that there is a continuity between the energy levels of a non-interacting Fermi gas and those of an interacting system. And this leads to the concept of a quasi-particle, which has the same quantum numbers as the electron. Okay, so it has a momentum k and a spin sigma, and it can be characterized by a certain distribution function and k of sigma, which is essentially the Fermi function. Okay, and so Landau's idea was to consider essentially not a Hamiltonian, as one would typically write down, not a macroscopic Hamiltonian, but rather a functional, okay, that gives you the energy of an excited state of your many-body system, okay, which essentially in this language is characterized by a particular configuration of quasi-particles relative to the ground state. Because the ground state is a state where there is no quasi-particles, and as you go to higher and higher excited state, there are more and more quasi-particles. Okay, so this delta E is this energy of an excited state minus the energy of the ground state, and Landau realized that essentially this functional could be expanded in powers of the deviation of this quasi-particle distribution function here from its ground state value, okay, which is essentially determined by the shape of the Fermi surface. Okay, and so to leading order, what you have is essentially the energy of a single quasi-particle, and to next to leading order, there is an interaction between quasi-particles, a sort of two-body interaction that can be parametrized by some Landau function f, which is a function of the quantum numbers of the two quasiparticles that interact. Okay, so in principle, we can expand this further, but typically we try to look at the consequences of this, these two first terms in the functional. Okay, and so so this function f here, it plays a central role. So it describes the interactions between quasiparticles. And since we're actually focused on the regime of low temperatures, where we don't have too many quasiparticles, then these quasiparticles are near the Fermi surface. And in this case, this interaction function can be expanded in quantities known as Landau parameters. Okay, these are dimensionless quantities. They depend on an angular momentum number L and take spin into account via symmetric and anti-symmetric combinations. Okay, so the idea is to fix these momenta to be on the Fermi surface and expand these angular functions in angular momentum channels. Okay, and so essentially you have a theory that is characterized by a series of dimensionless numbers that will take a particular value in a given material. But apart from that, the theory is really independent of material details, and you can try to express everything in terms of these Landau parameters. And so the way this works is that one needs to find this interaction function, which is the most generic, consistent with the symmetries of the Fermi liquid, which are time reversal, spatial rotations. Okay, so this considers isotropic systems, and also spin rotations. Okay, so this is a completely symmetric state. And furthermore, we're focused on short-range interactions. Although this can be extended to longer range interactions. Okay, so so the great success of this approach was the prediction that essentially physical properties can be renormalized due to interactions. And this renormalization can be expressed entirely in terms of these Landau parameters. Okay, so the ratios between the quantities in the Fermi liquid and those in the Fermi gas are universal functions of these Landau parameters. For example, the effective mass is given by the symmetric P-wave Landau parameter. The specific heat coefficient is given by this ratio of effective masses, which in turn depends on this again. And things like the compressibility and the spin susceptibility are also given in terms of Landau parameters. Okay, so in principle, by measuring these quantities, one can determine the values of the Landau parameters in a given material. Okay, so it's quite a powerful approach. Okay, so what I want to do here is to try to construct a Landau theory of helical Fermi liquids. So essentially, a Landau theory for interacting versions of the surface states of a 3D topological insulator. Okay, so this is what I mean by a helical Fermi liquid. So we expect that there will be qualitative differences because here, we do not have spatial and spin rotations. We only have a combined rotation symmetry, as we will see. And of course, this is due to spin orbit coupling that is maximal, in a sense, on the surface of these materials. So there has been recent work that constructed the Fermi liquid theory for non-topological spin orbit coupled systems, for example, the Rashba two-dimensional electron gas. But this theory is somewhat complicated because in this case, one has two spin-split Fermi surfaces. So it's more like a multi-component Fermi liquid theory, which loses some of the aspects of the original Landau theory. Here, because of topology, okay, because we're allowed to have a single Fermi surface, actually the theory we will obtain will look effectively like a spinless Fermi liquid theory. Okay, so because we have a single Fermi surface, things will simplify dramatically. However, there will still be some important qualitative differences from the standard Fermi liquid theory. Yes.
Yeah.
No, that's right. It's a symmetric. So I'll show you pictures and I'll explain precisely what I mean by helical. Actually, it's a Fermi surface. I can draw it here. So here we're in two dimensions. So it's a single Fermi surface. But at each point, the spin of the electron is fixed by the momentum. So actually, the spin of the electron will essentially rotate around the Fermi surface. So such a Fermi surface where you only have one state per k point, but you still have spin, actually cannot be realized in any conventional two-dimensional system. It can only exist on the surface of a three-dimensional topological phase. So this is why it's a rather special kind of Fermi liquid. So this is what I mean. So it's a rotationally invariant system that preserves time reversal, but it breaks spin rotation and spatial rotations. However, it preserves a combination. It preserves a total angular momentum, Jz, although it breaks Lz and Sz. Does that clarify your?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, very good. That's right. So this is what I mean by helical Fermi surface. So yeah, okay, very good. So precisely this will show this even more explicitly. So the goal here will be to try to construct this theory. So in order to try to do something similar to what is done here, we need to know what are the symmetries of this helical Fermi liquid. So time reversal symmetry is very important here. It's the protecting symmetry of this topological phase, so we certainly will keep it. Furthermore, we will assume a further condition. So although from the topological point of view, only time reversal symmetry is necessary here, I will also assume rotation symmetry, okay, in the spirit of Landau Fermi liquid theory. And this is actually not irrelevant because there are quite a few materials that have circular or almost perfectly circular Fermi surfaces. So actually, bismuth selenide has a very round Fermi surface. Within experimental accuracy, it's round. This BTS material has a similar property. So again, this illustrates the winding of the spins around the Fermi surface. And this one, I think this is some experimental artifact, but again, the Fermi surface is essentially circular. Okay, so this would apply to these materials, but not to materials where you have warping effects. For example, bismuth telluride has a very distorted Fermi surface for which this would not apply. Okay, so to construct this Landau functional, first of all, because we have spin orbit coupling, in general, the distribution function of the quasiparticle will be a matrix, okay, because spin and momentum are coupled, so in principle, there's no spin rotation symmetry, so we should have to keep a matrix. So from a phenomenological point of view, one would write down essentially some single particle term and some interaction term, and this would depend on various spin indices, and so the single particle term would be essentially a Dirac Hamiltonian, and if you solve this Hamiltonian, if you look at the constant energy surface for a finite chemical potential, then this is the sort of spin pattern you would find. Okay, so this is called spin momentum locking. So standard theories of topological insulators essentially only consider this term. But now we will look at interaction effects. That's right. So here the difference is that this is not a microscopic Hamiltonian. This is a Landau functional. So it's quite different. So conceptually, so what this means is that, for example, you could try to calculate these coefficients in terms of some interaction strength. So if you do microscopic Fermi liquid theory, so this is something that has been done for the standard Fermi liquid, and you can actually write down what does this correspond to microscopically. So this actually corresponds to some four-point vertex of the quantum field theory. So it's not some bare interaction strength. It's really some four-point vertex that sums an infinite number of diagrams. But, right, so one could derive this functional from some microscopic theory, but what I'm saying is that the form of this phenomenological theory is independent of the microscopic Hamiltonian.
But my question is that with such kind of function, can you also compare some corresponding local quantum which is also phenomenological?
You cannot, because it's diagonal in number operating.
That's right. Because of the Fermi surface, that's right. So if you are at the Dirac point, yeah. So in fact, actually, I will essentially be taking a limit of large chemical potential. So this breaks, that's right. This is highly non-local in momentum space. I'm sorry, in real space, that's right. That's right. So for example, there are some formal justifications of Fermi liquid theory. If you do some RG scaling towards the Fermi surface, right, so Shankar and Polchinski did that, and you can argue that only, for example, this angular function is essentially marginal in the low energy limit. And in fact, this is why, so I didn't say why I only kept In principle, an interaction has three momenta, okay, by momentum conservation. But here, actually, I only keep the angular dependence of these two momenta. So this is actually looking at a reduced interaction that only keeps the marginal part of the interaction. And this is why this leads to some finite renormalization of the physical properties that is controlled by these marginal parameters. Yeah, that's right. So here, I mean, maybe I haven't been very clear. So maybe you would want me to write a minus mu here. That's right. So here, in a sense, I wrote it. I didn't write it in the grand canonical ensemble, but you're absolutely right. So I'm really considering this theory at some finite chemical potential. Yeah, so maybe I should write minus mu here. That's right. So here, I'm not looking at the relativistic theory. I'm looking at the finite and, in fact, large chemical potential limit, where there's an actual Fermi surface.
Okay. No, we're putting it that your energy is very much less than the chemical potential.
That's right. That's
right.
How big that's right. That's right. Yeah. It's scale invariant. Correct. So I'm looking at physics that only involves this Fermi surface. That's right. But we'll see that there are some subtleties because of this helical physics. Okay. So very good. So symmetry. So this Fermi surface is circular. So you would say, okay, there is some rotation symmetry. However, if you look closely, so this Hamiltonian does not commute under. It does not commute with LZ and SZ separately. Okay, so Z is the axis of the out-of-plane axis, but because of spin-orbit coupling, only JZ is a good quantum number. Okay, and so this is a consequence of spin-momentum locking. In other words, if you rotate from a point here to a point there, you see from this picture that you also need to rotate the spin. Okay, so that's the only symmetry you have. And so what I will demand is what is the most general interaction function? Okay, this V. PP hat, PP prime, that is invariant under the symmetries of the free theory, which is this helical Fermi surface. So JZ rotations and time reversal. Okay, so that's something that you can go through, and you end up with a parameterization of this interaction function in terms of quantities that are analogous to the Lanar parameters. Okay, so there's three parts to this interaction. There is the pure charge interactions, okay, so delta rho here is essentially the quasi-particle charge density. And so there's an interaction in various angular momentum channels that is controlled by this Lanar parameter in the charge sector. So this is what you would get for a purely spinless Fermi-liquid theory. So this is not very new. And now spin-spin interactions are more complicated. So the exact form does not really matter, but I'll just point out what's a different form of the term. So there's actually essentially three classes of terms. This term essentially is like an XXZ interaction. Okay, this essentially looks like an SXSX plus SYSY term. This is like an XY Hamiltonian. And here there's a different Ising interaction. Okay, so this is not too hard to understand. Because I only have a rotation, this is a 2D system, and there's only a rotation symmetry around the z-axis. So in general, the in-plane interactions and the out-of-plane interactions will be different. Yes? Delta S is essentially, so remember I had this quasi-particle distribution function, which is a matrix. So from this, you can construct charge and spin densities. Okay, so the charge density, delta rho, will essentially be, you know, the trace of this. So contract this with a delta function. And then you can construct some spin density, which is essentially contract a Pauli matrix. With this. Okay, so you should really think of this as some distribution function. And if you look at its diagonal part, is a charge density. And if you look at its off-diagonal parts, it gives you the spin density. Okay. That's right. Okay, so the first term is some XXZ type interaction. There's also a Jelichinsky-Maria type interaction. Okay, so again, this only involves the in-plane terms, but because we have a broken rotation symmetry, okay, so we know that in spin-orbit coupled systems, we will generically get these so-called DM interactions. So this is present here as well. And this very complicated term doesn't matter what the exact form is, but essentially it's a term that is only invariant under combined spin and momentum rotations. Okay, so this is the type of thing you would find in a compass model on the lattice. So these compass models are models of spins on the lattice that essentially entangle the spin and lattice degrees of freedom. Okay, so this is some kind of continuum version of that. And this you can only find in models that do not have a separate spin and spatial symmetry. So in the standard Fermi-liquid, you would only get an S dot S term. And here you have a much more complicated structure. And the last interesting difference is that you actually have direct interactions between spin and charge density. Okay, so in a standard Fermi-liquid, this is forbidden by rotation symmetry. But here, because we only have a rotation symmetry in the plane, okay, you can actually construct a direct interaction between the charge density and the spin. So that's really a new feature of this system. Okay, so if we put everything together, we actually have, for each angular momentum channel, we actually have 10 different lateral parameters. And if you compare it to the standard Fermi-liquid theory, it only has 2 parameters. Okay, so because of the broken spin symmetry, we have a much more sort of a richer structure. Okay, so so we can go a little bit further. So as Will was saying, we're really interested in looking at the physics near the Fermi surface. Okay, and the theory that I wrote down really is taking, in a sense, the whole Dirac cone into account. So we can go further and try to project things on this Fermi surface. In other words, we can try to see if we can discard this part of the Dirac cone that is at very is very far in energy from this Fermi surface. So formally to do that, what you can do is you write the operators, fermion operators in the spin basis in terms of the eigenstates of this free Dirac cone, which is characterized by a helicity. So you have eigenstates with positive energy that have a positive helicity, and you have eigenstates with negative energy that have a negative helicity. And so these are created, these are annihilated by these operators, psi plus and psi minus. And so what we can do is throw out this part of the spectrum. Okay, so that will give us a simpler theory. And what is interesting about this theory is that if you throw out this P minus component, you essentially have only one operator. And then the theory becomes effectively spinless. Okay, so you can forget about this plus index here, and you have psi of P, which is a spinless operator. So if you insert that into the previous expressions, you get something simpler, which is what we call the projected Fermi-liquid theory, which is effectively spinless. Okay, so now it really describes only degrees of freedom on or near this helical Fermi surface. Okay, and this is the form that it takes. So there's a single particle energy, and now this distribution function only describes the fermions on this Fermi surface, and now we have a new set of parameters, and now the theory is effectively spinless, but these parameters can be related to the parameters of the sort of microscopic theory. Okay, so preserves time reversal. That's right. So this Fermi surface is time reversal invariant by itself, because time reversal sends this k point to this k point here. So it preserves time reversal. That's right. I'm sorry, a renormalization? Yeah, you can think, that's right. You could think that, right. So I guess what you're thinking of is you're integrating out these bottom states. That's right. So think, that's right. I think that's how you can think about it. You scale towards this Fermi surface and you throw out the upper and lower parts. Here I'm just formally discarding the lower part. But as you'll see, there will be some, it works well for most properties, but some properties, it will forget some of the physics. Okay, so I'll come back to that. Okay, so, all right, so before I go on to explaining how these are related to the unprojected Landau parameters, so let's say once you have this effectively spinless distribution function, how do you calculate properties of the physical theory? Well, to do that, you need to know how the physical charge and spin densities are related to this projected distribution function. Okay, so this can be done. Again, you drop the lower helicity, the negative helicity parts. The charge density is the same. The spin density basically just tells you what this pattern is. Okay, essentially tells you that if you have a fermion So if there's a fermion with a certain density at P, the spin will be at 90 degrees with the momentum. Okay, so this simply, yes. That's right. So however the, yeah, it's a little bit like that, but so there's a big difference because for Dirac, at a fixed mu, you really only intersect a single cone. So there's really one Fermi surface. For the Raspa case that has been done previously, really at low energies, you really do have two Fermi surfaces. You cannot drop the other one. Here you can because it's a high energy contribution. Okay, so that's kind of the big difference. So in a sense, you only have one helicity here of this Raspa theory. So this in-plane spin essentially embodies this spin momentum locking. And furthermore, what this tells you is that there's no z component of spin on the Fermi surface, okay? which is certainly what is observed experimentally, for example. Okay, so this simplifies things quite a bit. And now, even though the only thing you need really to experimentally what you would measure would be, for example, these projected quantities, but they are related to sort of microscopic parameters in this way. Okay, so there's some fairly complicated expression, but the only important sort of take-home message here is that when you project, when you do this projection, okay, this can actually raise or lower the angular momentum of the interaction. Okay, so what this means is that you can start from an effectively isotropic interaction, some L equals zero interaction, and when you project, because the Fermi surface has this helicity or this chirality, this will raise the angular momentum of the interaction. Okay, so you could start from some isotropic S-wave interaction, and you would generate an interaction in the P-wave channel in the projected theory. Okay, so this there's a in the field there's a well-known analog to this in the superconducting case, which is if you take an S-wave superconductor, okay, which is really an isotropic attractive interaction, and you look at the type of superconductivity you get on the surface of a 3D TI, you actually get something like a P-wave superconductor. You get like a P plus IP superconductor. Okay, and really the reason for that is that as you project near the Fermi surface, which is what Fu and Kane did for this particular example, you get an effective P-wave attraction. Okay, so here this only says that it's a more general phenomenon. It works also for repulsive interactions, and it's a general feature in any angular momentum channel. Okay, so also, so spin-spin interactions and spin-charge interactions will contribute in various ways to this projected Fermi function. Okay, so I'll okay. So the last part is basically what are the physical properties that come out of this? Okay, so now once we have this Lano functional, then we can really turn the crank and just apply the standard methods of Fermi liquid theory, and to study the physical properties. Okay, so. So there's similar normalizations of physical properties. Here, there's no effective mass because you have a sort of a relativistic theory, but you can talk about the Fermi velocity instead, and you see there's various finite normalizations. So it looks very much like a spinless theory, but remember that these projected Lanau parameters are really functions of these complicated spin-spin and spin-charge and charge Lanau parameters. Okay. Yeah.
So you have no mass, but it looks very much like a regular Fermi surface, right? If you're near,
that's right. So that's right. So that's why I mean, in the standard Fermi liquid, you could also write this in terms of a V, normalization of V.
Because you can linearize the spectrum.
That's right. That's right. So the only marginal parameters you have are KF, which is fixed by the Lutzger theorem, and you have VF, which is renormalized. Okay. So the coefficients, so the expressions are similar here. So you have some different coefficients, but These are quite similar. Okay, so for the spin independent properties here, it's fairly similar. For the spin susceptibility is a little bit more subtle. Okay, so it turns out that the spin susceptibility actually in a helical system is not a purely Fermi surface property. Okay, and the idea is that if you apply magnetic field in a spin degenerate system, you can always choose the spin quantization axis to be parallel to the field. And this will essentially simply split the bands, and you will have a change of occupation numbers, which is diagonal in the spin basis. Okay. Here, you do not have this freedom to choose the spin quantization axis because it is fixed by this helicity. Okay, so this means that actually it's not a purely Fermi surface property. but you can still try to calculate it and see what you get. Okay, so if you calculate it in this Fermi-liquid theory, projected Fermi-liquid theory, you find this renormalized in-plane susceptibility, and the out-of-plane susceptibility is zero. Okay, because in our theory, there's no z component of spin. If you compute it in the non-attracting theory, but keeping both helicities into account, you find a different result. Okay, so it's actually not universal. It depends on the cutoff, which tells you that it's not a Fermi surface property. But in the limit of large Fermi energy in this formal limit, the two theories agree. Okay, so what I'm saying here is that for spin properties, one needs to be careful, and the theory is not exact in a sense. But in this limit of large Fermi energy, there is a correspondence. And furthermore, what I think is more interesting, and which we conjecture is still true, is that the in-plane susceptibility is normalized by this F1 parameter, whereas in the standard Fermi liquid, it's normalized by F0 antisymmetric. Okay, so it's a different, it's normalized by the P wave component of the interaction, and that reflects this helical nature of the Fermi surface. Okay, so almost done here. So one other thing that one can do is to look at the so-called Pomerangic instabilities, and so these are instabilities towards a spontaneous distortion of the Fermi surface. Okay, and so this can be studied in this projective theory by standard methods, and the stability criterion obtained by Pomerantchuk here has an analog, which is given by this projected Landau parameter. Okay, and so we can see a reflection of these instabilities in the various coefficients. So the L equals zero instability is given by a divergence of the compressibility. So this is typically interpreted as an instability towards phase separation. Here we have an instability towards ferromagnetism, which interestingly here is given by an L equal one instability. Okay, so that's quite different from the standard Fermi liquid. And one can also look at the L equal two instability. Okay, so that's a new instability, at least new in the context of these Dirac fermions. And here, essentially, it's a nematic instability, so an instability towards a quadrupolar distortion of the Fermi surface. And so in the projected theory, it looks like a spinless nematic distortion. But in the in-projected theory, it looks like some fairly interesting spin-dependent order parameter that was looked at in these recent works. Okay, so our own, actually, the form of the nematic order parameter for the Majorana fermions looked precisely the same, and was also looked at in 3D spin orbit coupled metals by Liang Fu. Okay, so it shows up in these sort of helical spin orbit coupled systems. Okay, so this concludes the second part in the whole of my talk. So essentially what we did was to construct a Landau theory for this new class of Fermi liquids that are strongly spin orbit coupled. So what we get at the end of the day, is an effectively spinless theory. So that's quite different from both a spin degenerate and a non-topological spin orbit coupled system. So practically, these properties were given in terms of these projected Landau parameters that are related by a richer set of unprojected Landau parameters. And an interesting aspect was that if you projected the Fermi surface, this actually changes the angular momentum of the interaction. And in principle, because this is a very general method, this could be used to determine the strength of interactions in an actual topological state or material. So by measuring, for example, the Fermi velocity, which you can get in ARPIS, and various thermodynamic quantities, and by comparing them, you can, in principle, extract these values of F0, F1, et cetera, as is done in standard Fermi liquids. Okay, that's it. Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. So that's a big difference between the two that I didn't really talk about. I just wrote it on the board here, but that's right. So the derivation is a little bit more complicated, but the only thing that you really care about is the fact that the velocity operator is actually independent of interactions. Okay? So as long as you have an interaction that is not momentum dependent, Okay, so you certainly require translation invariance in both systems, but you further need to require that the interaction does not have any spatial derivatives. And if that is the case, then you will actually see that the interaction, the velocity operator is the same. Okay, so this is something you derive from the microscopic theory. So imagine you have some Hamiltonian now. There's some non-interacting part, and there's some interaction part. So this would be given by, you know, the bare Fermi velocity here, and P cross sigma, I guess dot into Z. Okay, and so to calculate the velocity operator, okay, one way you can do this, in first quantization, you would say that this is the commutator of x with the Hamiltonian. So if you do this calculation, okay, so the H naught term will give you Vf, essentially sigma cross Z. But what happens is that if this interaction here is independent of momentum, okay, then actually there's no, so x and v is zero. Okay, so this velocity operator is really given by the bare Fermi velocity, and that in turn tells you that the current, the particle current, is also unaffected by interactions. So what you do now is you say, well, that's true, but adiabatic continuity tells me that the flux of electrons and the flux of quasiparticles must be the same. And then you equate the flux of electrons given by this and the flux of quasiparticles, which depends on this quasiparticle velocity, okay, which is a different quantity. Okay. And by equating the two, then you find this relation. So you don't have Galilean invariance, but actually it's not strictly necessary. The only thing you need to have is this less restrictive property that the interaction does not have any velocity or momentum dependence.
So in some sense, you are using the fact that there is no velocity coupling, and also you are using the fact that the quasi-particle charge is the same as bare charge.
Correct, exactly, precisely. That's the only two things you need to derive this. So it's actually more general than Galilean invariance. Correct, yeah.
So the second question is, can you comment on the zero sound?
Yeah, so that's something, yes. Yeah, so I didn't write these things here, but we can actually calculate zero sound and first sound using this approach. And I don't have the formula in my head right now, but essentially it's rather similar. So the first sound, the zero sound velocity depends on F naught bar projected, and the first sound, the hydrodynamic sound, depends on F naught F1 as well. So the actual formulas are different than those in the standard Fermi liquid, but in a sense, they have they involve the same Landau parameters.
So the reason I'm asking about the zero sound, first sound, is because when you derive those things from a liquid theory, you have two ingredients. The first ingredient is you have this Boltzmann equation, and the second ingredient is that you need to know those energy functions. Depends on the deformation of the Fermi surface.
Right.
So in the Boltzmann equation, so I'm just wondering, when you have a Hadamard Fermi surface, in general, those particles are moving, so their band structure actually has a better phase.
Right.
So when you derive Boltzmann equation, I would expect that you would have to take those things into account.
Yeah, I think you're right. So I think so I don't think it will affect these properties. However, I think you're absolutely right that if you want to generate some more general transport equation, so for example, this is the type of things that Chen Yu and others did, for example. So they're looking at a semi-classical equations of motion, for example, and you need to add these cross terms between V and X.
Yeah. Actually need to know the Hamiltonian, right? So
yes.
Because you are computing P over dt,
right.
Then you actually substitute both the Hamiltonian for the quasi particles.
Right.
So you have a very phase, yeah. Presumably those would actually enter the semi-classical Hamiltonian.
I think they will. I think that for certain properties, I mean, for example, if you think about, I mean, so the inclusion of bare phase effects in Fermi liquid theory was in a different context was done in part by Duncan Haldane. So he talked about this Berry curvature as a Fermi liquid property, things like that. And so I think this will affect things like the anomalous Hall effect and things like that. Yeah, that's a very, very good question. So I'm not quite sure here. I mean, in a sense, the Berry phase is included in some property. So this raising of angular momentum, that's a consequence of this Berry phase. The chirality is built in. The other thing, too, is here, apart from the spin susceptibility, I've really talked about scalar properties. If you really want to look at, right, so if we talk about collective modes and you want to look at what do they actually look like in spin and in real space, then there will be important physical differences. For example, in this pneumatic phase, so that's something that we want to look at too, is in the, okay, so we have this parametric criterion, but in the pneumatic phase, what do the Goldstone modes look like? I mean, they will have some spin texture associated with them. Okay, so that's something that will differ a lot from the standard pneumatic Fermi liquid. So I agree with you that I think if you want to look at all the transport coefficients, especially those that mix spin and charge, I think these Berry phase terms will be very important. For these sort of purely charge effects, I think is less important. But I agree with you that for full theory, you would like to keep those as well. Yep.
Can I ask what we want?
Yeah, that's right. Yes, in a sense here, what I've done here is classifying all possible interaction terms. So it's not really a classification of phases because I mean the solution of this problem can give you different phases. In a sense, you may want to ask, you know, what is the phase diagram of this system as a function of these parameters? So it's a fairly complicated problem. I mean, a partial answer to that is this parametric instability. So it tells you that at this simplest level, for this projected theory, the only thing that matters is not the 10 separate Landau parameters, but one linear combination of these, okay, which is this projected Landau parameter here. So if this quantity is greater than minus 1, okay, so that was this parametric criterion, then the helical Fermi liquid is stable. If one of these coefficients becomes less than minus 1, so it exceeds some critical interaction strength, if you will, then in principle you will undergo a phase transition towards some symmetry breaking state or some different phase. Okay, so here the only thing this tells you is that at the simplest, you know, for really close to this Fermi surface, the only thing that matters is this FL. And so these are marginal parameters. So in a sense, there's a region of stability with properties that are normalized by this. And but in a sense, there's one helical Fermi liquid phase, but there's many different possible broken symmetry phases that are accessed by making this sufficiently negative. So yeah, so I think at this level essentially tells you that there's one effective Landau parameter that controls the physics. Although one could, in principle, look at this full theory with this this 2x2 distribution function. Okay, that really keeps both direct cones, both cones into account, and this might, for example, fix the problem with the spin susceptibility. Okay, but at the price of having a more complicated theory. So it wouldn't look like a standard Landau theory in a sense.